Welcome to Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Lillian Ross, who's got a new book, Reporting Back, Notes on Journalism, also the author of the classic book, Picture, from the 1950s, about the making of a movie called The Red Badge of Courage. Lillian Ross also has been with The New Yorker, writing for The New Yorker since, I believe, 1945, and has many tales to tell about The New Yorker, had a long relationship for many years with its longtime second editor, William Shawn. Did you know the first editor, Harold Ross, particularly well?
Oh, yes. Harold Ross is the editor who hired me. And although he was averse to the idea of having women at The New Yorker, he said that women cried if their pieces were rejected, and that made him very nervous and very unhappy, and he didn't want women at The New Yorker. And The New Yorker was supposed to be a male-oriented publication, which in a way it was. But as soon as the first four women came to work there, and he saw that they were good reporters and useful to him and good for The New Yorker and all, that was the beginning and the end of all that.
Did he ever talk about the early days of The New Yorker and how hard it was to get started or how easy?
Oh, yes. And apparently it was difficult. They didn't have any money, and there were times when it was about to go under. But I think it wasn't long before it caught on. And then Alan Mackey, I believe her name was, who was a society figure, wrote a piece about her life and her group and the position of social figures in New York at that time. And it created a lot of attention, and that was the beginning of The New Yorker having been taken up by not only society figures, but people in the know, people who are supposed to be sophisticated. And then those two geniuses came along to join Harold Ross, who was a genius too. And they were E.B. White and James Thurber. And they established what became New Yorker writing to a very, very great extent. When I did that book called The Fun of It that The New Yorker brought out, which is a collection of talk of the town stories from 1925 until 2002, I was able to see myself for the first time how James Thurber is the man who taught me how to write a talk story. I wasn't aware of it, of course, but by then he had established a certain kind of tradition, certain kind of form, certain kind of energy, and a certain tone. And it was good, solid reporting. Thurber himself had been a newspaper man, and he had that those disciplines ingrained in him. He was wonderful.
The New Yorker, from what you're telling me, from what I've read certainly, has a very specific style, almost a New Yorker style. I mean, this was true more in the days before Tina Brown than perhaps, you know, afterward. Did you ever feel constrained by that at all?
Never. And I don't think it's really true, because the New Yorker, from the beginning of my experience with Harold Ross and William Shawn, always encouraged me to have the freedom and to use my talent for whatever it was, to do a kind of writing that was mine and mine alone. And I think that tradition has continued. And Tina Brown not only encouraged that and welcomed it, but even stimulated that whole tradition to a very, very great extent.
When you began at The New Yorker, you kind of came in through a little bit through the back door because it was tough for a woman to get published. At what point did you feel as if you were really part of the family? How many years did that take?
About 10 seconds.
Really?
Oh, yes. Because as soon as I was there, I could feel that this was the place I wanted to be. And I've never wanted to work for any other publication since.
When you began, you fit into that niche that Thurber had established, the talk of the town. You use the we, as you talk about in your book Reporting Back, instead of I. And you always, I notice in all of your work, even though you're present, you're invisible at the same time. And that seems to be a very specific style that you use. We know Lillian Ross is there.
Yes.
We have to know she's there.
Yes.
But even in picture,
yes,
she's also not there.
Well, I very, very strongly believe, and I go into that to some extent in the new book, I believe that your point of view as a reporter and as a writer should be implicit in the fact. And that's very difficult to do, but it's a real challenge, and a challenge that I welcome. And I've not only been able to do that in long pieces, but in the Talk of the Town pieces, which are short, they're 800 to 1,000 words, and the challenge is to write a real story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and to find a story that no one else sees, no one else finds, but you find it, and it's the truth of that particular event or incident or person that you're writing about. So the we is something that felt comfortable to me for the beginning, and we used it. But after a while, I began to feel a little edgy and a little impatient with it. And I began to write stories as scenes. And Bill Shawn, who had become editor by then, welcomed that. And it was a way of getting a little more action into it, and it moved a little more quickly than the old stories and were more dramatic. And I've loved doing that.
Do you try to avoid using the word I then?
No, I can use I when it's called for. It isn't necessary to use we. In the old days, Harold Ross wanted the we to be anonymous, and in a way he wanted it always to be what he called a masculine we. But that was a lot of nonsense once the women came in, because there was no difference. The we was always a reporter, and a reporter who was trying to be a good writer and trying to present the truth in a way that was entertaining and that moved quickly.
Lillian Ross, how easy or hard is it for you to find that perfect opening sentence?
It's easy. One sits down, and I am a firm believer still in traditional who, what, when, where, and how. The essentials that are used to be taught, and I believe they still are, in what are called journalism schools. I follow that, but I have always tried to push it a bit and find my own way of opening a story. But I still believe that I owe it to the reader and to myself to establish a beginning that is a key to what the story is going to be all the way through, whether it's a short piece or whether it's a longer piece of writing. There's an expression that was made up about me that's absolutely ridiculous, and Bill Shawn said it was stupid, and that is the expression "fly on the wall." Well, there's no such thing. It wasn't true of me ever, even though somebody made it up, and then it became a kind of thing that was used and is even taught in journalism schools. And then even I, years later, heard from a kind of novice editor, well, you ought to go out and go to the store and be a fly on the wall. You're not a fly on the wall. You're chemically involved in whatever it is you're reporting. The relationship you establish with the person you're going to write about is very, very important. You have to listen carefully and listen to what the person is saying to you, and listen with your own ears and not with a tape recorder.
I happen to know that when I do that, and I've done that for pieces I've written, I sometimes get it wrong. Now, if I've got the microphone, I can't get it wrong.
No, it isn't a question of right or wrong. It's getting a sense of what the subject is that you're trying to write about. And once you get that sense, you will also hear the rhythm of the speech. And there are things you can do, even with quotes, that can make it truer of the person than the way it comes out in a realistic recording of what is actually being said. Because you take the quotes and you use it in a certain pattern. You choose some quotes and you take out other quotes. And without your interjecting yourself by choosing certain facts or even choosing certain quotes to make a story out of it.
Okay, let's take an example. Okay, you have a recent story about Tony Curtis in The New Yorker.
I was, as you, just before you asked that, I was thinking of some quotes in that story.
Okay, be specific. What quote do you remember is more Curtis than Curtis would have ever said?
Exactly. His having talked about how his son at the age of 23 died of a heroin overdose.
And Wilder's comment.
Exactly. Oh, you're a pretty astute. You're a good reader. Okay. He said a week after his son Nicholas died, he went to Spago and he saw Billy Wilder and he knelt down at Billy Wilder's table and he said to Billy Wilder, "My son Nicholas died of a heroin overdose." And Billy Wilder's response to him was, quote, "He learned it from you," unquote. And then Tony Curtis eventually in the story goes on to say how that hurt him very much. And Tony Curtis says in the story, "I made myself forgive him."
Did Tony Curtis actually say that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
But it's up to me to arrange the sequence of these facts. And quotes are facts, are what we refer to as facts, too. It's up to me to arrange the sequence and to choose these particular quotes out of everything Tony Curtis said to me at one time or another. And also it's in the context of one aspect of acting that he learned from Billy Wilder, and that's what he calls the fast response. And he said Billy Wilder was... that was ingrained in Billy Wilder. One of the reasons he forgave him, he said, is because he understood that that's the way Billy Wilder was, to not to let any time elapse, but immediately to respond so that your response comes in and almost shuts out what the other person is saying. And he learned that from Billy Wilder in his acting. And he explains to me in the story that one of the reasons he forgave Billy Wilder for having said this unforgivable thing to him was that he understood that Billy Wilder was devoted to the quick response. And that was the main thing with Billy Wilder. And he had, and this is also in the story along with his talking about how he was afraid of Billy Wilder because there was something about Billy Wilder that was frightening to him at that point in his life, that he was quirky and mean. He used the word mean and he used the word quirky. Well, it's up to me to place all these various elements in the story while building it and while writing it, so that it has a certain kind of effect on the writer without my making a speech as the writer about what it means and all the rest of it.
Sure, but if you're not taking the, if you're taking the notes, if you're sitting there, if there's no tape recorder, right, Couldn't you suddenly become, in a way, Janet Malcolm and Jeffrey Masson?
No, never. It's impossible for me to become Janet Malcolm.
But you understand what I mean? I mean, the fact is that if you don't have the backup, right, and you're doing that sort of creation, there is the problem that you could go over the edge, and then you've got a situation where the other person comes back and says, I never said I was a whore. I mean,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah. Well, I never had that problem in 50 years of working as a reporter. I never had anybody I wrote about ever say that I never said that or it wasn't true and it wasn't like that. I never had that experience. And I'm proud of that, but I sort of take that for granted because I know in the way I work that I'm finding a kind of truth that I have my own way of presenting and my own way of writing. Janet Malcolm is an entirely different kind of person, I think, and thank God I'm not like Janet Malcolm, because I don't believe first of all, I don't think she understands reporting. For starters, but also you don't use your reporting as a way of expressing your animosities, your hostilities, your dislikes, your intellectual pretensions, your intellectual prejudices, and a number of other things on the laundry list.
You're listening to an interview with Lillian Ross, whose latest book is Reporting Back, Notes on Journalism. Having said that, I want to throw out a few names, because it's one thing to write a profile, to meet someone and write a profile, and you let your feelings come through your choices, not directly, not saying, I hated that person, or whatever, you know, or trying to keep it clean in that way, and of course it comes out. We all know that since we're all subjective beings,
exactly,
on some level it will always come
out. Exactly.
I mean, you can write clean, clear prose, it's going to come out. But it's not going to come out directly. So I'm going to ask you about some people and get some direct answers from Lillian Ross, because over 50 years you have met an extraordinary number of,
yes,
of amazing people. So let me throw out some names to you. Some are,
before you do that,
okay,
may I say one thing to,
sure,
you?
Sure.
First of all, I never write about anybody I don't like. If I'm going to choose a subject, I'm not going to choose to spend precious moments and weeks or even years of my life with somebody I don't want to be with. So that's for starters. Secondly, I have strong opinions. I have strong prejudices. And I have very clear interests. And when I do a story about a person, I'm not interested in certain gossipy aspects of that person's life. To me, those elements are boring. What interests me, for the most part, is talent in people and what people have to offer the world in a creative way. And to me, that is absolutely fascinating and endlessly fascinating, because there are so many diverse kinds of talent, thank God, in our universe.
Well, then you're trying to get to the root of those people, which is why I'm,
yes,
curious. And some of these people may be people you haven't interviewed, and if you say, I don't know them, I never met them, I'll just move on. Let me throw a few out at you. Richard Nixon.
I actually wrote a Talk of the Town story about Richard Nixon.
I know, and you didn't like him.
Of course I didn't like him, but this was not a story about how I didn't like Richard Nixon or about his politics. It was a story about before he was elected president. And he was living in New York, and he would take a daily walk from his very high rental apartment to the Pierre Hotel, where he had an office. And I described this walk, and I used Nixonese as a way of describing him. Let me make this perfectly clear. That was a fire hydrant.
Let me throw some other names. John Huston.
Well, he was absolutely fascinating. First of all, he was very generous and very helpful to me. I met him for the first time. The first time I went to Hollywood, it was before, a couple of years before he invited me to come and watch him make The Red Badge of Courage. But I went to Hollywood. It was one of my very first pieces, and it was called Come In Lassie, and it dealt with the House Un-American Activities Committee investigation of so-called communists and communist propaganda in movies. And I did this story about the people and how they were reacting, how they were cowardly. Frederick March, I remember, who had given an ambulance to the loyalists in Spain, was called a communist. And he said, "I was no communist. I was just a big ambulance giver." Yeah, and as like that. Well, then I went to the Warner Brothers studio where they were making the movie Key Largo, directed by John Huston, with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall and Edward G. Robinson. And they were talking about all the things that had happened during the investigation, including going to Washington and making protests, and some of them going to jail for contempt of court because they wouldn't answer certain questions and said it was none of the committee's business. Their own way of their own vote was a private matter. But John immediately appealed to me because he was independent. He wasn't careful about the way he said things. He spoke his mind. And he was a lot of fun. He had a great sense of humor and a lot of fun. We became friends as a result of my having written that piece. And he loved the piece. And I remember he wrote a letter to Harold Ross, who was an editor, and Ross sent me a copy of the letter and all that. And then every time Huston would come to New York, he would call me up, and I would just have fun with him. And then he invited me to come out to Hollywood and watch him make The Red Badge of Courage. And at that point in my life, I was trying to get out of the emotional involvement with William Shawn, who was then managing editor of The New Yorker. And I welcomed the opportunity to go to Hollywood, and I did. I not only went, but I stayed there for a year and a half, working on what became the book, Picture. Of course, the way my life evolved, love is a powerful, powerful, powerful element in our lives. And Bill Shawn and I decided to make our life together when I came back a year and a half later. And we did. And the book Picture, by the way, the 50th anniversary edition is the edition that has just been published, and I love boasting about, after all, not too many people have 50th anniversaries of anything. And Angelica Huston wrote a preface to the book, but Huston was generous, and his producer, Gottfried Reinhardt, was a wonderful man, also generous and helpful. I had a great time in Hollywood. I have a couple of scenes in the book about L.B. Mayer, who was a terrible man in a certain way. But I happen to love good, honest, upfront crooks and monsters, as long as they aren't exercising cruelties that are visible to me.
When you were writing that, did you ever feel yourself becoming seduced by Hollywood as if you would want to write for them? Or
no.
Did you want to just get right back to the comfort of the New Yorker?
No. Well, it wasn't the comfort of the New Yorker. It's just that I seem to have had a one-track mind in my life. There wasn't any other kind of writing that really appealed to me and still doesn't. Because in the kind of writing I do, I have scenes, and I have dialogue, and I have many of the elements that I find in movies I admire, or in a few plays that I admire. And I find that I can do whatever it is I'm driven to do in the kind of writing I do and have done for The New Yorker. The New Yorker gives me that freedom, and it gives me the wherewithal, and it gives me the support, and it gives me the encouragement. And from the beginning, it was Harold Ross, and then William Shawn, and then Tina Brown, who shook up the magazine and did all kinds of new and wonderful things to it to make it her magazine. And now our young editor, David Remnick, who is a kind of genius in his own right. And he's taken the magazine she made, and he's made it his own. And it still gives me an opportunity to write exactly what I want to do. So, no, I could have given you a simple one-word answer to your question. I haven't been seduced.
And you haven't written fiction, I would guess, for that reason.
I've written some fiction.
You have.
I wrote a series of, I pride myself on knowing that it was the first time satirical stories had been written about psychoanalysts and psychiatrists in New York. And it was published as a novel eventually. It was called Vertical and Horizontal. And I've written a few other fictional stories.
What about the world between fiction and nonfiction as exemplified by, I think it was called New Journalism,
yeah,
books like Armies of the Night by Norman Mailer,
yeah,
or In Cold Blood?
The best journalists are wonderful writers. And you're a good writer or you're a bad writer. And Norman Mailer is a wonderful writer, but he has his own way of doing his writing, and we used to, he's a friend of mine, and I loved talking with him. We used to argue with him way, way back before he got into writing Armies of the Night and so on. And I would say I believe in keeping myself out of the stories. So naturally, Norman Mailer, being Norman Mailer, wanted to do just the opposite. And it's wonderful. He's a wonderful writer, and anything he does has something marvelous about it. But he's a fiction writer.
Lillian Ross, obviously you're never going to retire. I mean, you keep
doing
this.
Oh, God, no. Hope not.
Is there anyone in 50 years who you really wanted to interview, might have come close to write a profile of, but never got a shot, and you just damn wish you had?
I don't think so. I can't think of anybody I longed to write about. Those I wanted to write about, I think I've written about.
You've been listening to an interview with Lillian Ross, whose latest book is Reporting Back, Notes on Journalism, also now out reissued, Picture. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.